Okay, we are continuing with the last phrase in the Mishnah, first Mishnah. Va'asus yog la'Torah, make a fence around the Torah. We've already explained the idea of why the rabbis instituted these fences, where the Torah gave them the authority to do so, whether what they do is mandated by the Torah in a mitzvah or just the will of the Torah, but it's purely rabbinic. And we explained why this is not considered adding to the Torah. I mean, I'd like to go into a few more ideas about these fences around the Torah. First of all, there are a few different kinds of fences that the rabbis made. They work in different ways, how they protect the Torah. The first is very simple. An example would be, the rabbi said, don't handle matches on Shabbos because you may come to light them. If you don't handle them, then you'll be much more removed from ever lighting a fire on Shabbos, even unintentionally. But if you're handling matches the whole day, you may forget yourself and end up lighting a match. So therefore, they prohibited handling matches on Shabbos. They made it muktzah in order that you shouldn't come to light matches. According to some opinions, the whole idea of muktzah is those things that are not necessary to handle and carry on Shabbos, to move around on Shabbos, either because the nature of their the purpose of them is something that's not permitted on Shabbos anyway, or they're not something that a person needs. They're not a kli, they're not a utensil that a person needs to use. The various categories of muktzah, one of the reasons why the rabbis instituted is you shouldn't come to carry. Because the less things that you're moving around, the less chance you have to carry things in a prohibited way on Shabbos. So these are all similar kinds of gzeros. They made a gzera that you can't take esrog and lulav on Shabbos. If Sukkot falls on Shabbos, you don't take esrog and lulav, even though the Torah says you do. The rabbis came along and said, we're afraid that if we let people take esrog and lulav, they may, on Shabbos, they may forget themselves and end up carrying it into Rishus HaRabim, into a place where you're not allowed to carry on Shabbos. So they prohibited taking esrog and lulav, or blowing shofar, or megillah on Shabbos, for fear that you may come to carry it. So this kind of gzeira, this kind of decree, is very simple. Don't do this action, because it could lead to a prohibited action. Handling matches could lead you to lighting matches. Okay. Then there is another kind of gzeira that's not so forthright and direct. And that is the following, that the rabbis prohibited various things that if we permitted them, then people would think you could do other things too. They're very similar to things that are prohibited. For instance, cooking or eating chicken and milk. Okay, you're not allowed to cook milk and meat. Kosher mammal meat, domesticated mammals, that's what's prohibited from the Torah. Can't cook cow's meat in cow's milk or any other domesticated mammal's milk. That is from the Torah, and the product you're not allowed to eat or have any benefit from. That's the Torah prohibition of basar b'cholav, milk and meat. It only applies to milk from a domesticated mammal and meat from a domesticated mammal that's kosher. Same thing with the milk. And it only is asur if you cook them together. Cooking is prohibited, and the product is prohibited to be eaten or having an enjoyment. Okay. The rabbi said that even though from the Torah you're allowed to cook chicken in milk, and you're surely allowed to eat chicken and milk together, right? You're even allowed to eat the product, the cooked product of chicken and milk from the Torah, the rabbis prohibited it. Not because that it's going to lead that moment to eating milk and meat, but we're afraid that if people see that you can cook chicken and milk, they're not going to distinguish between chicken and meat. and they're going to think you're allowed to cook meat and milk also. So therefore, the rabbis prohibited cooking chicken and milk for fear that people will learn from that that you can also cook milk and meat. They're very similar, right, because chicken also looks like meat. So therefore, they prohibited. That's another kind of decree where we're not so much afraid that you're going to do something prohibited now, but we're afraid that if we permit this permitted thing, it looks so much like something that's prohibited, people will learn from that to do the prohibited thing also. Another example, on Shabbos, it could be that it's only rabbinically prohibited to make a loose batter, right? To knead dough or to make dough is prohibited from the Torah. But to make a loose batter could be only rabbinic. Why did the rabbis prohibit making a loose batter on Shabbos? Because they were afraid that if you were permitted to make a loose batter, you wouldn't distinguish, and next Shabbos you'd make a dough, a thicker batter. Because very small difference between making a thick batter and making a dough and making a pancake batter or whatever. So therefore, I don't want to go into the halachos of that.
Oh, maybe someone would come to bake it.
What?
Or maybe someone would come.
No, that much not. But they made a gzeira that since these things are so similar to the prohibited thing, right? Or on Shabbos you're allowed to do things backhanded from the Torah. Okay. In other words, something that you normally do with your right hand in a regular way, if you do it with your left hand backhanded, it's called shelo kederach. It's not the normal way things are done, and therefore it's only prohibited rabbinically. Why do the rabbis prohibit it? Because it looks very similar to the thing that's prohibited. Right? If we let you do it backhanded, which is permitted from the Torah, people will not distinguish and they'll end up doing it the right way. And that's prohibited from the Torah. So therefore... What? Yeah, there, since it's Cholamoid, and since there are other Heterim, they permitted it if you do it with a Shinur. But many times, it's not permitted if you do it in an unusual way. It's rabbinically prohibited. Yeah. Yeah. Ah. Okay. Okay. We will do that as the finale of this. Okay. Yeah.
You say something about cooking on Shabbat.
Cooking? No.
Cooking.
I didn't speak about cooking. Even though cooking also, right? Cooking. I'll give you an example of another gzeira which applies to cooking. Cooking in the sun directly, poaching an egg in the sun is mutter on Shabbos. You're allowed to cook in the sun. Okay? You're allowed to take an egg, but you're not allowed to cook in things that were heated up by the sun. In other words, to take an egg and put it in hot sand that was heated by the sun is rabbinically prohibited. Why? Because cooking directly from the sun is enough different from cooking in an oven or with another heat source that people won't come to cook in an oven because they can cook in the sun. But cooking from the hot sand that's heated up from the sun is no different, doesn't look any different than cooking from hot sand that was heated up by a fire. Cooking in hot sand that was heated up by a fire is prohibited by the Torah. Cooking in hot sand that was heated up by the sun is only rabbinic. But since it's very similar, right, people see you can cook in hot sand and they won't realize the reason is because it was heated up by the sun, they'll come to cook in hot sand that was heated up by a fire. So therefore the rabbis prohibited cooking in something heated up by the sun, right, same way that it's asked from the Torah to cook in something heated up by a fire. Okay, so that's another kind, that's a similar kind of gezeira where we're not afraid that you're going to do something prohibited right now because you're doing this, like touching the matches, you'll come to light a fire. But if we permit this action, people will confuse it with a different action and think you're allowed to do that also. That's another kind of decree, another kind of gzeira d'rabbanan. Yeah.
Does that mean you could take a raw egg or an open egg, put it on a cold plate, and put it on a window outside?
Right, and let it cook.
And let it cook.
100%. But you can take it on a hot plate that was heated by the sun and do the same thing. Okay. That's why there's a difference of opinion with a Dut Shemesh. The water heated up by a Dut Shemesh, how is that heated up? Some people say that's heated up directly by the sun. And others say, no, it's not heated up directly by the sun. There's collectors in there and whatever that get hot and heat up the water. So it's not considered water heated up by the sun. It's water heated up by things that are heated up by the sun, which is prohibited. And there's a difference of opinion, whether a Dut Shemesh is considered water heated by the sun or water heated by things that are heated by the sun. The first case would be permitted, and the second case would be prohibited. Okay. That does not necessarily mean that you can use your Dut Shemesh on Shabbos. There are other problems with a Dut Shemesh. But because there are problems of after the... there are other problems also, so don't assume from what I just said that if you hold that it's heated up directly by the sun, you can use a Dut Shemesh. There are other problems with a Dut Shemesh also. Okay, in any case. Then there's a third kind of decree, which doesn't apply to either of these cheshashos, where the rabbis were afraid that you would do something either immediately or learn from this to do something else. For instance, the rabbis prohibited wine of a non-Jew. Wine produced or even touched by a non-Jew under certain circumstances. Even kosher wine that was touched by a non-Jew is sometimes prohibited, and wine produced by a non-Jew is prohibited. Now the Torah only prohibited wine that was libated, poured to idolatry. That wine is prohibited from the Torah. You're not allowed to have any enjoyment from it, no benefit from it. You can't drink it, obviously. That is wine that is prohibited from the Torah. That's called Yayin Nesech, wine that was poured to idolatry. But today, we're not afraid that some goy poured the wine to idolatry, right? If Gallo wine, right, is made by Mr. Gallo, who is not Jewish, so we're not afraid that all of his wine that he's doing set for sale was poured to idolatry. So it's not prohibited from the Torah. It's a rabbinic prohibition called Stam Yenom. The rabbis prohibited drinking wine that was produced by a goy or even sometimes touched by a goy, and they made it similar to wine that was poured to idolatry. Not because they were afraid that it's wine poured to idolatry, because even where it's not possible that it was poured to idolatry, it's still prohibited. They prohibited the wine because of intermarriage. Because if people drink together with goyim, they may end up marrying goyim. So in order to make a siyog, a fence, around the prohibition of intermarriage, they prohibited drinking wine produced by goyim. Now, that doesn't fit in to either of these categories that we mentioned. Right? It is very unlikely that if I go to the supermarket and buy Gallo wine, right, that I'm going to end up marrying Gallo's daughter, okay? Because I don't even know if Gallo has a daughter, right? I don't know him from a hole in the wall, and it's a commercially produced wine. Why in the world would the rabbis be afraid that if I drink his wine, I'm going to end up marrying his daughter? So it can't be in that category, that drinking the wine is going to bring you to marry a goyim. So what about the other category? Well, if I can drink his wine, I can marry his daughter. That's also a little absurd, right? Because one doesn't follow the other. Just because you can drink somebody's wine doesn't mean you can marry his daughter, right? Or his son, or whatever. So it's not that category either. That if we permit this, you'll think that if this is okay, then something else is okay too. So then, how does it work? What were the rabbis afraid of? Why did they prohibit drinking a non-Jew's wine, and it also applies to non-Jewish baked goods, cooked goods are also prohibited. You can't, that's bishulakum and pasakum, right? You can't eat things baked by a goy or cooked by a goy. And people who have non-Jews who work in their house, whether they're maids or Filipinos or whatever, should be very careful to know that they can't prepare food. And if they do, under certain circumstances, the food is prohibited, and the kalim that it's made in are usher, and you have to kasher them, the trait. So you have to know how to avoid this problem and still have someone in the house who may be cooking or baking or whatever. There are ways to get around it. That's not the purpose of the shiur now, to go into it. You should be aware that it's not so simple. Okay. And even if the woman or man cooks for themselves in your pots or pans, they make your pots and pans trait. So you have to know how to avoid that. So if you have such a situation, ask your local reliable Orthodox rabbi how to avoid having problems. Okay, next. So the rabbis prohibit a lot of these things in order that you shouldn't get intermarried with goyim. So how does it work? We're not afraid that if you eat their bread or eat their, what's it called, eggs that they bake, you're going to marry them. Like, that's obviously not the case. It's also not the case that, well, if I can eat their eggs, I can marry them too. That's also not the case. So what is it? Think over here, the idea is the following. The rabbis over the centuries, because of these prohibitions, created a mindset amongst the Jewish people. If you know that you can't eat bread baked by a goy, you can't eat an egg that was poached by a goy, you can't drink wine that was touched by a goy, you get a certain distance from goyim. Right? Obviously, you don't have that same feeling of camaraderie and closeness that you do to another Jew. Because I can't even eat what they cook. I can't even eat what the drink the wine they touch. So it creates a certain mindset. Yeah, goyim can be very nice, and can be very nice to them, and they can be very nice to us, and we can do business with them, and we can, but socially, there is a buffer that's created, a mindset that's created, right, by these prohibitions. It's not the kind of prohibition, don't do this because you're going to do this. Don't do this because it looks like something else that's prohibited. But don't do this, and over the years, it will create a mindset amongst the Jewish people to create a buffer between Jews and goyim. That, I think, is the idea. It doesn't fit into any of the other two categories. I'll tell you another thing that has both aspects to it, but the rabbis were extremely machmer by chametz for many reasons. The Torah also was machmer by chametz. All other prohibitions you can keep in your house if you want. You don't have to get rid of them. You just can't use them, right? If you want to keep pork chops in your house, right, you can keep them in the house. There's no prohibition of keeping them in the house as long as you don't eat them. You can't do business with them, but you can keep them in the house. There's no prohibition to do that. But chametz on Pesach, you can't. There's a bal yiroi and bal yimotzi. You're not allowed to, what's it called, to own chametz or to have it in your ownership in the house. Why is the Torah so machmir? So some say because, well, there are various reasons. But one of the reasons is because since chametz you can eat the whole year, so you may forget yourself and come to eat it. So the Torah wants it out of your possession. Okay, if that's the reason for the Torah, that's a moot point. But the rabbi said that even though theoretically you can get rid of your ownership of chametz just by declaring it null and void, and that would be enough from the Torah, we're afraid you may come to eat it. If you just get up Erev Pesach and say, all my chametz is considered to me like dust of the earth, and then I could leave it in my house, the rabbi said, we're afraid that you're going to forget it's Pesach and end up eating the chametz, because you eat chametz a whole year. It's not like pork chops that you never eat. But this is something you always eat. So you'll forget, and you'll end up eating it on Pesach too. So that is a simple decree. Don't have chametz in your house, even if you've made it null and void, because you may come to eat it. It's like the matches. Don't play with matches on Shabbos because you may come to light them. Don't handle them, you may come to light them. Don't have the chametz, you may come to eat it. That's very simple. But the rabbis made tremendously other chumras, other strictnesses when it comes to chametz that don't fit into this rule that don't do this because you may come to eat it, you may come to transgress the prohibition now. But the idea is they were so machmer with chametz in any areas that don't would not lead necessarily to do something awesome now, or even later. But they created a mindset. I remember my grandmother, Aleha Shalom. I remember that if they were sitting around on Chol HaMoed, right, watching television, and that's a little box with the screen or whatever, in case you don't want to admit that you know what it is. And in those days it was a little box. And something came on, a commercial about chametz. She turned off the set immediately and closed her eyes. Right now, that's obviously absurd. There is no isser. The isser was watching the television, not the bread. But in any case, but there's no isser of seeing chametz. Right? You can pass by a bakery and look inside on Pesach too. But because the rabbis made chametz like public enemy number one during Pesach, they created this mindset that nobody would ever think of eating chametz because it's like abhorrent. And that's what happened, and it works. You see that the people, what's it called, it's just the more scholarly you are, then the more you understand, you know, what's asur and what's not asur, whatever. Men, especially men who are talmidei chachamim, are much more lenient when it comes to the kitchen than their wives, right? I mean, there's a joke supposedly that a woman threw her husband out of the kitchen and said, "Between you and your shulchan aruch, you're gonna trafe up my whole house." So sometimes knowing more takes away this mindset. But if you don't know and you deal with the things the way the rabbis made these things very, very strict, you get the mindset that chametz is taboo. It's something you wouldn't even think about. And because of that, it protects the prohibition very, very nicely. I think that basar b'chala, the same thing. The rabbis went to tremendous lengths of prohibiting anything that is similar to milk and meat. Like we said, chicken, they asur, not only, the only issur is cooking it together and eating the product. But min ha-Torah, you can take salami and soak it in milk and eat it, as long as you don't cook it. You surely can eat it at the same meal. So the rabbis prohibited, that's exactly what happened, right? The rabbis prohibited not only cooking it, but eating it the same meal. Even you have to wait 6 hours after meat. So what did they do? They created not so much that, well, if you don't wait 6 hours after meat for milk, you may come to cook milk and meat. It's also pretty far-fetched. But that wasn't the idea. The idea is, if we make it that milk and meat are so far from a person's mind that when you think about it, you have that reaction. Look, who would want to ever eat a salami sandwich drinking a thing of milk? It's like abhorrent to a Jew. It's so far-fetched to even think about any kind of mixture of milk and meat. That's the third kind of gzeirah, where the rabbis created a mindset that made these things so far out of the realm of possibility that they made it that you could never even come to possibly transgress what the Torah said is awesome. Yeah.
Before you were talking about social mingling with the goyim, I was reading in Mishpacha that there was a situation where they wanted to have certain Orthodox people that were in politics be able to attend some kind of dinner. It was like a social gathering dinner, and they made everything a lot kosher and everything. And I read about it, reminding me of what Achashverosh. So why did they make it a lot kosher? That was like a social mingling with the goyim.
Okay, it depends. Okay, I don't know what the situation is, and I surely don't pass on shadows in the mishpacha. Even the good parts over there, when I'm in it, I don't consider it too much important. It's a nice magazine. It's good entertainment. I'm not going to get onto this again, but I assume, okay, that what they were reporting was something that was, first of all, for political purposes, which is not called social. That's political. And politics, as was for all the time that we're in Golis, right, the Yidden many times were allowed to do things that normally were prohibited rabbinically because of They were allowed to dress in Goyish clothing. They were allowed to, what's it called, sometimes even to go without a yarmulke. All these things are rabbinic for the sake of being able to deal with the government, the powers that be, the malchus, right? People are korav l'malchus. It's pikuach nefesh for Klal Yisrael to be able to deal with the government properly. So therefore, there were leniencies because it wasn't social mixing; it was political mixing. Yeah, okay, but again, but the main purpose was because these people were politicians. It wasn't because they wanted to have one happy picnic, you know, just down with the guy next door, which may or may not be usher, right, under certain circumstances. But by Achashverosh, it wasn't because they wanted to get Korav L'Malchus, and it could be that there wasn't a problem, like we said, that they went to the party. Could be they had to go to the party. The problem is they enjoyed it. It's a different story. And that party was celebrating the downfall of Klal Yisrael. So it's a different thing completely. Yeah.
With the comment, when you say it's Talmud Chacham, my father was in Talmud Chacham. He said that we always sold comments. As a matter of fact, my recollection, which I'm thinking is getting faulty, but anyway, we always bought an extra bag of flour before Pesach to sell, because he was worried about the
chometz
after Pesach,
and
you didn't know what you were buying.
Right, you didn't know if you were buying it from a Jew who didn't sell his chometz. Right. Yeah, okay. Again, if you know what the halachas are, then you don't have to be extra machmer where it's not necessary. But if you don't know what the halachas are, then, your fleishik and knife comes within 2 inches of your cold milchic, what's it called, bananas and cream, and you throw out the bananas and cream and throw away the knife.
We had a case like that when my husband was a rabbi. So one of the people came, he had to be open on Shabbos, but he was very ridiculous. He had a shiloh, they had guests for dinner, and they used a little fish of fish water.
That's not so bad. He asked before the fact. Usually people would come to say to me, Rabbi, I threw away all the dishes, but I just want to know if I did the right thing. Okay. Which brings us to the next subtopic of this Siyogin Latorah. Till now, we've discussed the rabbinic prohibitions that the rabbis instituted as fences around the Torah. But there's another kind of fence around the Torah that's more individualized, not what's it called, the institutionalized. Every person has to make fences around the Torah for himself, okay, where he knows that he is weak and needs an extra fence in order that he doesn't do something that's wrong. For instance, I'll give you an absurd example, because any non-absurd example will probably insult somebody. So we'll use one that somebody knows that they have a weakness to food. They can't control themselves when they smell some really good food. And there's a trefa restaurant on their block. And they know that every time they pass that trefa restaurant, it's like in the comic books, the aroma of the tray is wafting in the air, and it just picks the person up by his nose and brings him into the tray for restaurant to eat. He knows that that's it. He just can't control himself. Right? Whenever he smells the food, he just ends up in the tray for restaurant eating tray. So a fence for that person would be, don't walk on that block. Stay away from that block. There's nothing wrong with walking on a block where there's a trefa restaurant. But if you are the kind of person who can't control himself when he smells trefa and ends up going into the restaurant and eating, then for you it would be a proper thing to make a fence around the Torah and don't walk on that block. Only walk on blocks where there are no trefa restaurants. Right? So that's not a rabbinic prohibition. There is no institutionalized prohibition for everybody. But a person has to know himself. And he knows that if this is something that if I do it, it'll bring me to do something prohibited, or at least make it easier for me to do something prohibited, and I know that I'm weak, and I know that this is something that I better stay away from, then a person has an inyan to make his own personal fences around the Torah. However, if a person makes everything asur, then nothing's asur, because it's impossible to stay away from everything. So then you know that if you make chumras that make nothing permitted, then everything is permitted. In some schools, educationally, where they prohibit everything, right? Then let's say in tznius, they go overboard, right? And girls aren't permitted to wear anything that a normal person would want to wear, right? Then they are causing those girls to do something wrong, because it's impossible to toe the line, so therefore you have to not toe the line. So if you're not toeing the line already, so there's no difference anymore between wearing brown stockings or not wearing any stockings. If everything is aser and I can't do everything, so then why should I do anything? There is such a psychological feeling. So you have to be a chacham to know what prohibiting what will be beneficial and prohibiting what will not be beneficial altogether, where it's not aser, it's only a syog, it's only a offense, and it's not offense that the rabbis made, it's offense that you're making because of the situation. Which brings me to another thing. I mean, maybe we'll speak about this more next week. We will finish this topic next week, finish this Mishnah, and that will be the last shiur before Pesach, and we'll start with the second Mishnah after Pesach. So, but let me just start what I'm going to speak about next time in a little bit more detail. And that is this idea of chumras and kulas. There is normative halacha that applies to everybody. This is the halacha. Okay? You want to know, are you allowed to do this or not? You are or you're not. That's normal. That's a normal halacha for everybody. Because of extenuating circumstances, there are certain situations where you're allowed to be lenient. Where in the halacha itself, there's a room for leniency. Right? I'll give you a classical example. Okay? There is a difference of opinion, and we'll get to your thing because of this. Difference of opinion amongst the rabbis whether this chicken is kosher or treif. It has a certain problem with it. Many rabbis hold that that problem is not a problem. Some rabbis hold it is a problem. So the halacha is, under normal circumstances, you're not allowed to eat it. That's the halacha. The Shulchan Aruch, you look at the Shulchan Aruch, it says, don't eat this chicken. However, in extenuating circumstances, in a case of hefsid merubah, where it would be a very big loss for the person involved, they're poor people, and if they lose this chicken, they lose their meal. And they don't know if they can buy another one. Right? Hefsid merubah. Or shasachat, it's 10 minutes before Shabbos, and there's nothing else to eat. Then under certain circumstances, since this is not a clear prohibition, there are those that say it's okay. There are those that say it's not okay. Normative halacha is not okay. But in extenuating circumstances, it is okay. You can rely on those opinions that say that it is okay. Hefsid meruba is an example where it's a big loss of money, or it's something, a shasat chak, it's Shabbos, you're not going to have anything to eat for Shabbos. In those cases, you can be more lenient. Okay, so there's a time to be lenient. The opposite is also true. There's normative halacha, and in certain cases, you have to be machmer. You have to go beyond that and be strict. The normative halacha is this way, but it's in this situation, you have to be strict. Okay, sometimes that's a personal thing. Because normative halacha is that you're allowed to walk past a non-kosher restaurant, and you're even allowed to inhale and smell the aroma. Pashas, there's no issur in that, okay? But if you know that if you do that, you're going to end up eating the treif, you have to be machmer, you have to make extra, right, more than the halacha, and avoid, put a clothespin on your nose, or avoid walking on that street, okay? Is that halacha? No. That's a chumrah. But it's a chumrah that for your situation is proper because you know your weakness. There are situations where institutionally there's such time to be machmer or whatever, but the normative halacha is that you could be more lenient. But in certain situations, it's good to be machmer. Okay. The the example, if there are no esrogim and lulavim around, then this esrog is kosher. But if there are other esrogim, there's a lot of esrogim, you don't have to use this, you don't have to rely on the normative halacha, then it's an need to be machber and only use a better esrog. Something like that. Okay. In this generation, one of the problems is that people don't know what is halacha, they don't know what is a chumrah, and they don't know what is a kula. And therefore, some people who are machmir in things, right, who only do the extra strictness, because they don't know what the regular halacha is, think that that's the halacha. And therefore, somebody who's not strict, who's doing what the halacha says, they look at as a shekets, right, because they're not doing what's right. But they are doing what's right. It's just they're not being machmir like you are. But that's only a chumrah. The regular halacha is what they're doing. So not a shekets, they're doing what's okay. You're doing extra. But since you don't know what's extra and what's okay, you assume that what you're doing is what's proper and what they're doing is improper. The opposite is also true. There are people, for whatever reason, are lenient in things. Less than the halacha. Okay? They have leniency. This hechter, that hechter, whatever. That's not the normative halacha. That is based on the fact that, based on certain situations, they, whatever, have been accustomed to be more lenient. Okay? Which is not the regular halacha. It's a leniency. So they say, well, what I'm doing is halacha. And anybody who does more than that is a fanatic. But when the people who are doing more than that are doing what the regular halacha is, you're the one who's being lenient. And they're doing the normative halacha. If people would know what halacha is, then they'd be able to know if they're being lenient and the people who are doing more are not fanatics, they're doing what the halacha is. Except in your situation, maybe it's okay for you to be lenient based on the circumstances you have, whatever it may be. Or if they knew that they were being extra machmir, but they knew the halacha was that you don't have to do that, then they would know that what they're doing is more than necessary and what other people are doing is proper. But since people don't know, so people who are machmir consider that the halacha, and anybody who's not machmir is a shekets.
Right.
And the people who are lenient think that that's the halacha, and anybody who does the halacha is a fanatic. So everybody is pointing the finger at everybody else, calling them fanatics or shkatsim, when in fact they're just doing what the halacha is. So it's a good idea, right, before we discuss when to be machmir, when you could be makel, what are proper, is it always proper to be extra strict or maybe not? Is it for sure not proper to always be extra lenient, even though there are some people who hold it like philosophically, that's a mandate. A person should never be too machmir. He should be like in the middle of the road. Right? They have a word for it, which I'm not going to mention this week. When I can describe it and discuss it properly, I'll mention the labels. But this time I don't want to mention labels without being able to discuss them properly. But in any case, so there are people who think that being lenient is always proper. Some people think that being strict is always proper. The emphasis is that neither is proper. And it depends on the situation. Sometimes it's proper to be strict. Sometimes it's proper to be lenient. Sometimes it's proper to just do what the halacha is. Don't be strict and don't be lenient. How do you know those situations? What are the factors? That in Yitzhak Hashem we will begin to discuss next week.